New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlov. Today is a special program. It is an open-ended conversation with my friend Ed May, who has been a guest on New Thinking Aloud 11 times previously. For many years, Ed ran the government-sponsored remote viewing program at SRI International and SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, following the departure of Hal Puthoff. He is the recipient of a Lifetime Career Award from the Parapsychological Association, and he is co-editor or co-author of several books, including ESP Wars, East and West. The Stargate Archives, a four-volume set which he co-edited with Sonali Bhatt Marwaha. Also, Extrasensory Perception, co-authored with Sonali Bhatt Marwaha, and Anomalous Cognition, co-authored with Sonali Bhatt Marwaha. Ed is based in Northern California, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Ed. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure my as well. I remember with fondness of the 10 sessions we did when I stayed over at your house, and you still didn't kill me. So that was a good step forward.
As a matter of fact, just this morning I counted, and I think we did 11. Or maybe there was one subsequent that we did after your visit here, but I have 11 videos with you. And so by my reckoning, this is number 12.
Yeah. Okay. You have to send me the one I don't have.
Happy to do that.
Or at least a link to it.
Sure. And I think if we want to have a starting point, I know we've talked about Stargate and we've talked about precognition and we've talked about physicalism, but now many years have passed. I can't count the years, but it could well be 5 years since our last interview. And you've had a long career in parapsychology, so I'm sure you have many reflections on the field as a whole. And I'm just happy to hear if you have any new thoughts.
Well, first off, I want to tell you some surprising things. You know, of course, the National Security Agency, NSA. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, of course.
Their headquarters is in Maryland. At Fort Meade, Maryland. And it turns out, long story short, I ended up talking with the director of unclassified museums at NSA. Much to my surprise, they had an unclassified museum on cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. But he wants to have a temporary exhibit on remote viewing at NSA headquarters.
For a long time, it seemed as if, at least the CIA, when they did that air research report, they wanted to minimize their interest in remote viewing.
It's kind of the language of the day, but they lied through their nose. We have all the records that they declassified, and if they didn't think it worked, how come they came back and asked us to provide intelligence data 41 separate times?
Well, I presume the conventional reason is because they had reached a dead end using their other methods, and they figured, what do they have to lose?
Yep. Well, the way I work it now is a restaurant analogy. Suppose you wanted to open up a new restaurant, You got some modest funding, and gee whiz, it seats 19 people when it's full because it's a small place. You got the best chef in the whole region, a wonderful wine cellar and a wait staff and good decor. Open at night, 19 people come and fill up your restaurant, Jeff. And for the next week, 17 of those original 19 customers come back to your restaurant. What would you say about the quality of your restaurant?
High.
You get a gold star in that nice bald forehead like mine. Okay, from 75 to 95 during Stargate, we had 504 spying missions using remote viewing. Those were spread out over 19 federal agencies like CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, the Secret Service, and so on. All right? Of those 19 agencies, 17 of them returned with new and additional missions. Mm-hmm. You don't need statistics to know that the stuff is real and can be used. Now, the organization that came to us the most was after the Cold War was over. There's a group based out here in California called Alameda, and they their mission, their remit was to use try to interdict drugs coming in from the country from overseas. Mm-hmm. So they asked us. They said, "Hey, where can we board this vessel leaving Hong Kong or Singapore, full of bad stuff? Where can we board it in California territorial waters 2 weeks from today?" And we told them. They came back, Jeffrey, 171 separate missions. We were mighty, mighty good at that job. Why? I have no idea, but we were.
Well, that's important news. I think the public deserves to know about it. And every time I talk about the government interest in remote viewing, people ask me, do you think they're still doing it? Because officially, the program shut down, what, in 1996 or so?
You know why it shut down?
Well, I've heard different stories, and I'm happy to hear what you think about that today.
Well, I know the real story.
Mm-hmm.
First off, when the AIR, American Institutes of Research document was produced, they didn't give me a copy of it, even though I had sent them a whole bunch of stuff. By that time, I knew the ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee, William S. Cohen. And I went into his office, and everybody around him calls him Bill, so I'm not bragging about it. So I said, "Bill, I don't have that damn document." He says, "Here, take mine." And he asked me, he charged me with a job. He says, "Write a blistering review and publish it about what a terrible job they did." I said, "Okay." So I did that, published it in the journals and what have you. And Jeff, everything I said in that was completely and utterly wrong.
Oh.
So what happened was, and the CIA released this, it's their story, that as the Cold War was over, the House of Representatives, who were the hold of the purse strings, were kind of griped at the CIA because they had a huge budget during the Cold War, but now they don't need quite that much money anymore. So they were told to start whittling down programs that were small compared to the big problems. And they said, if you do not do that, and it's a quote from the CIA, from the Congress, we will shut down the CIA if you don't do that. That was the threat. Mm. And there were half a dozen programs that got killed, and one of them was ours.
And your program was tiny. It was infinitesimally small compared to the overall CIA budget.
Yep. Oh, yep. Well, they were bitched about, apparently there were a lot of small programs that added up to some money.
So it's understandable that there would be a cutback after the end of the Cold War, that funds would be reallocated to other projects. At the same time, the remote viewing was obviously working, and one would think that enough people in many agencies understood that and had need for continued services. So I have to imagine that other programs got started up and were probably kept secret.
I don't think so. Let me give you the arguments. Back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and maybe first part of 2000. From that time onward, intelligence collection techniques have gotten far better than they were in those days. And a lot of things they couldn't answer then, that we had to use remote viewing to do it, which is a crappy way to get information. There's a phrase called HUMINT, H-U-M-I-N-T. That means World War II type spies, human intelligence. And there's SIGINT and all those other ints. And what they told us, that we are as good as HUMINT and as bad as HUMINT. Because, you know, when humans are making, whether they're remote viewing through field glasses, or, I mean, regular viewing through field glasses or doing remote viewing, you still have all the necessary crap that we put in our experiences. And the techniques are now much better. So that's one of the reasons. Now, when one of my trips to Russia, the guy that headed their remote viewing spying group, General Alexei Yurovich Savin, said to me, I would like to have a joint program with you guys because we have a similar problem, and that is terrorism. Mm-hmm. And we had been trying for a decade to get his organization chart. He handed me his organization chart, and he said, I know you're going to go talk to the people at DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. Tell them I want to have a joint program. So I wrote up a 30 or 40 page piece on it, and I went to the Pentagon, and I'm in the head, the admiral, three-star admiral in charge of DIA, and I said, here, let's have a joint program with these guys. First off, it's immensely cheap, as you just pointed out, and it doesn't put anybody in harm's way. A bottle of scotch and an evening at home will get you everything you need. And this guy wants to do it. And that guy said, hey, this is really a great thing. I'm going to Moscow anyway in about a month, and I'll bring it up. So I walked out the door. You could practically hear him throwing it in the trash. Hmm. So didn't happen.
And of course, these days, the prospect of doing something like that is even more remote, I have to imagine.
Yes, it is. It's oddly enough that it's been more popular under Republican administrations than it is under Democratic ones. The other interesting news is, based on the book ESP Wars, it turns out that there is a documentary well on way of being made. Mm-hmm. We've got enough funding for it, and we'll probably have, not quite sure yet, so I won't mention the name, a well-known person to do the narration. But the documentary producer has arranged one of the best distributor of films, and he has letters of intent of 105 different countries around the planet that want this documentary based on this book. Mm. That's pretty impressive. I mean, you know, yeah. We all worried we should get the good stuff out to as many people as possible. That's a pretty good way of going about it.
It is.
So I'll probably be interviewed my part of it. I'm the executive producer. Now, what's really funny, what do I know about being a producer? Absolutely nothing, but I'll learn it on the job.
Well, it can be a slow process to produce a documentary. It may be a couple of years from now before it's released.
No, it'll be out much faster than that.
I hope so, but I've heard that before, I can say.
Well, this guy who is doing it has produced a number of documentaries that are really top of the line, and the distribution channel is all squared away, and it's not going to be just a bunch of talking heads. Mm-hmm. You'll be hiring actors to play some of the roles that we can't get to. Like, no way in hell am I going to Russia. I could, but I'm not going to.
Well, that's very exciting. And it also brings up the memory of a time when it seemed as if détente between the U.S. and Russia, it was more than a détente. You had very friendly relationships.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of my favorite guys there, Boris Ratnikov, General Boris Ratnikov, he was in charge of Yeltsin's security detail. And you don't think of KGB guys being funny, but this guy had a wicked sense of humor. And I don't know if I ever related to you the last time we talked about it or not, but His first job as a major in the KGB was political officer on a Soviet-era pleasure cruise boat. I said, pleasure cruise boat in the Soviet Union? You got to be kidding me. No, 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 we had one. Yeah. Okay. So they're out in the middle of the Mediterranean. His job was to keep people from defecting when they pulled into Western ports. So that was his job. Okay. They're out in the middle of the Mediterranean, bored out of their mind. The women on the boat decide to hold a beauty contest to elect Miss Cruz. Well, Major Boris Ratnikov, KGB, dresses up in full drag and enters the contest. And wins! And I said, Boris, are you that cute in a dress? He goes, oh, I'm gorgeous in a dress, just like that. But when the other women, when the women found out about it, they tried to drown the poor guy in the swimming pool. He had to fight for his life. That story's in this book. So years later, one of the top remote viewers, Angela Ford, and I were in Moscow in 2015 at a party, and Boris was there. And he came over, and I said, hey, I know you're pretty in a dress, but you're prettier than she. And I pointed down to Angela. He looked down at her. No one's prettier than she, he said. And I said, what the F are you, when the F did you become a politician? We had a good laugh over it. Too much vodka.
I think it's a shame that the relationship between the U.S. and Russia has deteriorated to the point it has, given I have friends who are Russian as well, who were dear friends.
I know. And I wouldn't go there because I'm a prime candidate for prisoner exchange.
I mean, we're speaking on the day when the news just came out about the Wall Street Journal reporter sentenced to 16 years as a spy.
A number of years ago, there was a meeting in Hong Kong funded by a Chinese guy by the name of Bingo Wu. That's his name. And I and four other Westerners were there with a bunch of other people. The second year for the second version of that conference was being held in North Vietnam at a now closed North Vietnamese army base. And he was going to pay my way. He's a very wealthy guy. He was going to pay my way over there, and I thought that's pretty cool. And I looked up where it is. It's 20 kilometers from mainland China, and I would not risk it. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Because when I was in Hong Kong, I showed some spying data that we had on the Chinese of a nuclear test. So they knew who I was, and no thank you.
Just being near the Chinese border was a concern.
Yeah, 20 kilometers. Come on, they could get hold of me if they wanted to. So my days of roaming around behind the old Iron Curtain are over.
So you've got the documentary you're working on, and I imagine you'll have some involvement with this museum exhibit at the NSA.
A major one. The three remote viewers, we will have remote viewing demonstrations. And we are available to the public to answer questions and all that kind of stuff.
So it would be an opportunity for, particularly for people in the NSA, because the museum exhibit will be right there at their headquarters, I presume.
Well, it's open to question. They have some room to do that, but we expect a large number of people. I myself have about 150 people that should come, including you. You should show up. So the secondary option, they haven't made up their mind yet, will be there's a new spy museum in Washington that is quite spacious compared to the earlier ones, and it might be theirs. They haven't made up their mind yet. This will happen in October, so we've got some time to think about it.
Well, it would seem to me that both of these things, the book and the museum exhibit, are likely to be a catalyst for new projects, new ventures, and probably within the government to reopen or relaunch remote viewing programs.
It's not good enough. It's simply not good enough way of collecting intelligence, because there are much better ways of going about it now than there weren't available back in the days of our Stargate.
Well,
I'm the skeptic of it all.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In other words, you would participate in these projects, but you're not encouraging other government organizations to re-engage.
I would certainly not encourage business to start using this to help business decisions, because it's only about 20. Look, the best. Here's an example. Joe McMonagle is a very well-known remote viewer, and I have all of his data at both at Fort Meade and at SRI when it came to us. Mm-hmm. And you can plot how good his remote viewer is, and I won't bore you with the statistic, as a function of time.
Okay.
First thing that comes out of that is practice does not make perfect. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of wiggle up and down, and you fit a straight line through it, and the slope of that line is 0 to 2 decimal places. The good news is it doesn't decline. Yay. But the bad news is it doesn't get any better with practice. So one of the reasons I'm doing some neuroscience down in Brazil is to find out what is different about his brain compared to my brain. Mm-hmm. Because clearly there is a difference. Not everybody can do this. And the clue that we have, which I didn't know about when we talked earlier, that all of our top remote viewers are synesthetes. They experience synesthesia.
Yep. We did bring that up. You said that's what you suspected. You didn't know whether it was true or not, but it was a hypothesis you had at the time.
Yeah, well, now we know it's true. I measure all the, even the new people. And what we're trying to do, that is a clue, I think, because there's a great deal of neuroscience studying these people. So, you know, hey, I'm too old. We need some younger people, and I'm working with a whole bunch of new remote viewers.
You are?
Yeah.
Is this in relationship to the work going on in Brazil?
Some of it, yes. Some of it, no. I have a contract with the folks in Brazil. And we're trying to find new people and work on some clever little programs.
And you're also engaged in neuroscience work with the Brazilians.
Yes. There's a technique in neuroscience called diffusion tensor imaging. And what that maps in the white matter of the brain, very visually beautiful. If you go to a site called the Human Connectome Project, you'll see some of the things. It's so beautiful, you want to put it on the wall. It's gorgeous. Because it does, depending upon the false color, of course, depending upon the direction the information is flowing, it's color-coded to tell you what direction the information is going. For example, on their site, you can look at the optic nerve, which comes to the back of the eye, to the hippocampus, and then to the back of the head. And you look there, and it's bright yellow. You can just see it coming from the back of each eyeball, and then it diffuses to the back of the head. Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous. So you can get a quantitative number of how much hyperconductivity there is in the white matter. We propose, just giant hypothesis, could be completely wrong, that the more communication within the white matter means you're likely to be psychic.
And also be a synesthete.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, what I would do if I had lots of money is to get a bunch of synesthetes together, and I would be held blind whether they're synesthetes or not, and test them all for remote viewing ability, because I've got a fairly standard test that works pretty good.
And then see if there's a correlation. Is that the idea?
No, the idea is the synesthetes, I'm blind to whether they are or not, get much better ESP scores than the non-synesthetes. That's not a correlation. It's just a straight statistic.
Okay. A comparison. Fair enough.
Yep.
So that's exciting. Here's what I'm getting from this conversation. First of all, I would say that you are just as committed to the physicalist approach as you were when we last discussed it.
More so.
And second of all, you seem to feel that the neuroscience research is likely to lead to a deeper understanding of how precognition and remote viewing function in the brain.
Yeah. In fact, if it works, the folks down in Brazil get a Nobel Prize. And I tell my colleagues, you better pay for my trip to Sweden so I can watch you get the degree. Because then, Jeffrey, for the first time in psi history, we will have a mechanistic way to determine who's psychic and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet, and maybe we'll never get there. But right at the moment, that's a hypothesis that deserves testing.
Well, I understand that the people at the University of Virginia, the DOPS program there, are also very interested in working with remote viewers to determine what physiological correlations, I'm using the word correlation again, are associated with hits as opposed to misses in a remote viewing process.
Oh my goodness, that's a Johnny come lately. You probably know this from the time you wrote your book all the way forward. Parapsychologists have been looking exactly at those same correlations for 40 or 50 years. So I'm not sure what new things they're bringing to the table.
Well, as you point out, the techniques are improving all the time.
That's good news, yeah.
I understand that the work that, to which I'm referring is in a very preliminary stage at the moment. But yes, I mean, using fMRI tests to try to correlate that with ESP hits has been reported in the parapsychology literature decades ago.
You know, that won't work. I'll tell you why. First off, fMRI is a very slow process. It takes 10 seconds or so to see anything. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you're making an enormous assumption, which for the most part is definitely not true, that psychics can become remote viewing when and if they want to. And that's not true. For example, I did a detailed study at Stanford University on with some of the best people, Joe McGonigal being one. And the experiment was set up that let me give you a background to it, and I won't get geeky on you. There were 3 5-minute segments when Joe was there. In the first 5-minute segment, he was in an EEG chamber, and you know all that stuff, very careful measuring EEG, and at a distant location, nobody looking at a monitor facing the wall, there was a picture there, and the picture would come on for 1 second on, 1 second off, 1 second on, 1 second off, and so on, and Joe was to do remote viewing quietly because when you start talking, it messes up the EEG. So for the first minute, he had to sit there and just remote view that stuff. The second 5 minutes, he could then make notes and talk about what his experience was. And the third 5-minute period, we showed him the actual picture for feedback for 5 minutes, looking at his EEG. And the idea was anything, in fact, my neuroscience friends get pissed off at me when I tell them, the brain is a dumb slab of meat. It can't do 2 things simultaneously. And the 2 things that it can't do, and this is true, is produce alpha rhythms and do anything else. And alpha rhythms in the brain are, moderately, is a brain in idle. So what happens is if you get a stimulus or loud noise or someone pokes you in the ribs, alpha rhythms just vanish while that happens. So we said, well, hell, if ESP is real, and when you have an ESP experience, then that must also interrupt alpha for the time being. It didn't work in our study. Mm. And one of the real problems is Joe probably had all the remote viewing he's ever going to get in the parking lot coming to the lab. In fact, I had a $150,000 contract to work with Bob Morris in Edinburgh with an fMRI machine to look at somebody in the fMRI, and we're measuring skin conductance in their hand at the same time. And I sent the money back. I said, first of all, I don't know who is the subject, who's the subject of the experiment, the experimenter or the participant, and who the hell knows when to put them in there. That's another big mystery because maybe all the ESP happens outside. Mm-hmm. And so I sent the money back and it was reprogrammed.
Not many people would have the integrity to turn away a grant of $150,000. Did you write the proposal and then, after it was approved, reject the funds?
I was in Edinburgh and rejected the funds. I talked with Bob about it quite a bit. And it's been a problem for throughout history of PSI, and particularly remote viewing, about when does that happen. And the other big mystery is, how long is the when you have a psychic experience? Yeah. Is it continuous or does it come in quick bursts or what have you? Nobody knows the answer to that. But usually fMRI, if you're measuring the brain stuff in fMRI, I wasn't. I was measuring skin conductance, hoping to see something. I mean, fMRI is called BOLD, and that's blood oxygen level moving through your body, and moving liquid through your brain is a very slow process. Mm-hmm. So if this is a fast process, you'll never see it anyway. In fact, a neuroscientist by the name of Stephen Coslin and one of his then graduate students, Stan Moulton, did a binary ESP test in the participants were in an fMRI machine, and they didn't get any good result, and they published that it doesn't work. Therefore, they said that ESP is not real. So I happen to know Coslin pretty well. We had lunch together here when he was at Stanford. And I said, Steve, you really screwed up on that experiment. No, I don't screw up in any of my experiments. I said, oh, yeah? Did you check what the effect size estimate is for binary ESP guessing? No. Well, you should have, because even if people were experiencing their binary guessing in the machine, then you didn't have anywhere near enough statistical power to see it in the first place. Mm-hmm. He looked at me, stood up, reached across the table, and shook my hand. He said, it's rare to get caught in a mistake. That was a mistake on my part.
Right.
Published in the Cognitive Neuroscience Journal, and I wrote a letter to have it retaken away, but they left it.
This issue about statistical power is one that Jessica Utz, who I know is a colleague of yours, has been discussing for years and years. It's an obvious thing for parapsychologists to be aware of.
Yep. Did you ever see, I'm sure we talked about it, she was elected as president of the American Statistical Association.
That's right.
She would be the top statistician in the country. Mm-hmm. And when, as president, she gave a 70-minute talk as president, and I edited that down to a 7-minute segment because she, in public, in front of that group of people, she describes her interest in ESP.
We have a interview with her on the New Thinking Aloud channel, in which, if I recall correctly, she said the statistical evidence for ESP is stronger than the evidence that taking aspirin will reduce heart attacks.
Yep, it is. I told her it was a darn good thing that when that was formed, they didn't make it the American Statistical Society, because the acronym doesn't work very well.
Well, Jessica is a gem. She's been a great asset to the field, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, she worked in our lab, my lab, for a year. We were close buddies, yeah.
Back to the AIR report. You critique the AIR report, and you're claiming that there was politics going on, but it would seem, politics or not, that a criticism of the AIR report would still have been valid.
Well, virtually it was, because what's called a CDA, Congressionally Directed Activity, the House of Representatives put out to the CIA saying, you have to do a 20-year retrospective analysis of remote viewing over that period of years. Yeah. And if you find it to be accurate, then we're going to switch the whole program from Defense Intelligence Agency to you, and we'll carry on. Okay? They looked at the last year only.
Right.
Oops. You can't conclude any damn thing. And I gave them the list of about 15 end users, including someone at NSA. They didn't interview any of them. Not one. So they did not do a study. It was a hatchet job at the get-go.
So,
and Senator Cohen thought so as well.
These are the things that you wrote about and published at the time.
You bet.
And I just want to go back, because you made a statement earlier in which you said that the things you wrote about and published at the time were all wrong.
What I wrote about as to why they closed down the program, that part was wrong.
Or incomplete.
All the critiques I said were correct.
Okay.
The program was not closed because of that.
I see. That, good. I'm glad we clarified that point.
So, you know, what bothers me, I did a finger counting. I've been doing parapsychology research for 49 years, which is almost 50, and that's the end of it for me. when 50 comes along, I quit. I'm going to do something else.
You know, I remember you from those days, Ed, when you first got started in the field. I remember the time when your car key got bent by Uri Geller. You were unable to drive your car at the time. It was an Audi.
Yep, that was a big mistake.
I remember you had built a large device. It was about the size of a suitcase, as I recall, and it was a random event generator.
Yes, in fact, that's going to be on display at the NSA, mm-hmm. because I managed to get it out of the American Society for Psychical Research as part of the Stargate Archive, and it was in Rice University archive stuff. Mm-hmm. And the woman there in charge of it shipped that to this guy, Vincent, at NSA. So it's going to be on display there.
Nice. And since you mentioned Rice University, I think it's worth mentioning that the Stargate archives that you have are going to be part of their Archives of the Impossible that Jeffrey Kripal has established.
Jeffrey and I have known him for quite some time. He's stayed at my house. We play golf together and so on. And actually, I've asked him an interesting question. In my experience in Russia, and as you know, I've been there many times, that their people are falling all over themselves to be part of their equivalent remote viewing program. Mm-hmm. They love the stuff. And over here, I had a contract with the Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it was like $1.5 million program. And an undersecretary of the Air Force said at the time, quote, "It is the work of the devil, kill that program." And they came and took our money back. So I asked my wife, what the hell's going on? She says, I know the answer to that. Oh, really? What is it? Turned out that from the time of Luther and the Reformation and Vatican II, the thing that's happened as a result of that is we've taken mysticism out of the practice of religion mm-hmm. to a large measure. The Russian Orthodox Church is nothing but mysticism. First of all, there's no place to sit. You're holding a candle, and the priest comes in, pays zero attention to the flock, and mumbles something incoherently to an icon on the wall. Why do that? It's pretty mystical. So I've asked Jeffrey Kripal to look into this to see whether it makes any sense rather than just waving our hands about it. Makes sense to me.
The fundamentalist person who canceled the Air Force contract because he thought it was the work of the devil would be different than the mystical approach of the Eastern Orthodox Church in Russia, where they're less concerned with the devil. Actually, I understand the head of the Russian Orthodox Church is a CIA or a KGB or former KGB agent.
Could be.
But yes, from all the accounts that I have heard, there's a very strong mystical tradition within Eastern Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah, same with the Greek Orthodox Church, same way. And the interesting thing, those two variants of Christianity did not participate in the Crusades, did not have 900 years of, what do they call it?
Witchcraft persecution?
Yeah, any of those.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to become a Christian, that's the place to join up.
I've done a number of interviews with a fellow, Charles Upton, who is a religious traditionalist. And the traditionalists believe that there's a common thread that runs through the mystical traditions of all the world religions. And he's very big on the Eastern Orthodox approach.
It's sad for me because, in my view, Moscow is one of the most beautiful cities I've ever visited. It's gorgeous. And when you say the Kremlin, everybody goes, eh. Do you know what's primarily in the Kremlin beside the office buildings?
Museums, I gather.
Museums and parks and 8 churches.
Mm.
Now, what I'm about to tell you is made up from whole cloth, but it makes sense. During the Cold War, early starting of the Cold War, most Americans were ignorant with regard to what communism was. So this is the part I made up. So CIA had this problem to get everybody behind fighting the Cold War and just trying to make it sure, well, it's communism. Well, who the hell knows what communism is? Hardly anybody does. And actually, there's never been a communist government in the history of the planet so far, yeah. Even though people have tried. And so we said, okay, there is a way we can get it. Everybody understands what godless is. We call them godless commies.
Yeah.
Except Stalin attended one of those churches every week through the entire Stalinist era. The Russians are highly and still religious as all get out.
It would be just as valid to talk about godless capitalists.
Yeah, right. There, well, good point.
Ed, we've covered a lot of ground. We've talked about the museum exhibit that's coming up. We've talked about the documentary that's coming up. We've talked about the neuroscience research you're involved in with a group in Brazil.
Jeffrey, thank you very, very kindly. I love you as an interviewer because you and I have fundamental disagreements about materialism versus not, and yet you don't put that on me in the interview process, and that is a brilliant capacity as an interviewer, and I thank you for it.
I'm always interested in anything you do. I only wish I could be as good a scientist as you.
Oh, I love you, man. That's fantastic. Thank you. Can I get a sworn affidavit on that? Because I could sure use it. All right, yeah. Sir. Thank you very, very much.
For those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here.
Book 3 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogue series is UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.